For the week of December 18th, 2011, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 130, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling-Reich.
And in New York, I'm Michael Giltz.
How are you doing, Michael?
I'm doing great. My mom is coming shortly to visit for a few days, and then we're going over to my brother's in Allentown, Pennsylvania for the holidays, which means we do have a break coming up.
That's right. For a couple of weeks, the next 2 weeks, we're going to be taking off for the holiday break, and we hope you have you're actually going to be the one taking off, Michael. I don't know if you can boo yourself.
Oh, well, sure. I do it all the time.
Well, so December 26th and January 2nd, there will be no show, but we will be back in the new year bringing you all of the entertainment news. And we're going to be bringing you the entertainment news from the past week on today's show. You know, you'd think that approaching the holidays, a lot wouldn't happen, but that's not the case. On today's show, we're going to bring you up to speed and, in fact, try not to bore you with the latest year-end award nominations news. Last week, both the Screen Actors Guild and the Golden Globes announced who's in the running for this year's prizes. We'll fill you in. Apple TV rumors are beginning to heat up again now that the Wall Street Journal is participating and spreading them around. We'll tell you why you don't have to care about them. In the world of digital convergence, it was a heck of a week. On one hand, you had a dispute between Universal Music Group and file sharing site Mega Upload infringing on the media's fair use rights. And on the other hand, you had comedian Louis C.K. showing that it's totally possible to turn a profit by selling unprotected content directly to fans. And those are just two of the stories that have been going on, and they have nothing to do with the uproar over Pippa and SOPA, the two anti-piracy bills making their way through Congress. During Inside Baseball, we're going to be joined by Joe Fleischer of the media measurement and tracking company Big Champagne. He's going to be here to discuss why Live Nation was interested in acquiring them last week. Of course, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines during Big Deal or Big Whoop. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
And the number one movie around the world is Tom Cruise's new flick, Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol, which grossed $81 million worldwide. In the U.S., it had a relatively limited release, and yet it still grossed $13 million. It was only on IMAX screens. And people are obviously excited to see the movie, but they're also excited to see the trailer for the final Batman movie. So this was a movie that opened big around the world, very modestly this week, but opening up again later this week in a much wider release. So a very hot start for a franchise. Remember when they said Tom Cruise was over as a movie star? $81 million around the world.
Well, really, when you think about it, a movie star kind of waxes and wanes. And that's the definition of a movie star. If you only, you know, peak once, then you're not a movie star. You're a, you know, kind of a one-hit wonder or a fad. But, you know, look at John Travolta. He was big in the late 70s. He kind of disappeared in the 80s and came back in the 90s. It's a perfect example.
Right. Nobody makes every film a hit. It's just not possible.
Yeah, and Ghost Protocol, I think I wouldn't necessarily call The Dark Knight Rises or whatever it's being called. That's not a trailer so much as a 6 or 7 minute excerpt from the film.
It's the first few minutes of the film, the first 6 minutes of the film, just like the last time they released the trailer with the bank heist, which gave us our first glimpse of a Heath Ledger. And so that's exactly what they've done with this film. And it was very, people were definitely flooding to the IMAX theaters and paying top dollar, not just to see Mission Impossible, not just to see Dark Knight, to see both. But definitely that was a big draw and it helped. But clearly, this is a hot property. It grossed $81 million worldwide. Number two at the box office.
But, you know, before you move on, I know you don't like IMAX. Like seeing films in IMAX, but
IMAX is fun for movies that are shown in IMAX. You know, when you have a film shot in IMAX, that's great. This passage from the Dark Knight film, whatever it's called, was shot in IMAX. There are a few minutes of Mission Impossible shot in IMAX. It's not enough for me to want to see that because it is, in general, a bad movie-going experience. You know, you have to have exactly the right seat. It's too big. You can't follow the whole screen, especially in an action film. It's really hard. But at least some of these two movies were shot in IMAX, justifying it to a degree. When you go see something like Harry Potter in IMAX, then you're just an idiot. You're paying extra money to get a worse viewing experience. You really have to rethink what you're doing in the theaters. But that's just me. Number two at the box office around the world is Sherlock Holmes, A Game of Shadows, starring Robert Downey Jr. and Jude Law in their second film as Holmes and Watson. It grossed $54 million worldwide, and it was the number one film at the box office in the U.S. Number three is Puss in Boots around the world. That grossed $31 million worldwide. It's at $331 million and counting. Well down from the Shrek films, but it's a solid launch to a franchise, perhaps. At number four around the world is Alvin and the Chipmunks Chipwrecked. Not as funny a name as the Squeakquel, thank you. But it grossed $38 million worldwide. Both Holmes and Alvin and the Chipmunks are down from their last film openings. But as everybody pointed out, those movies opened like on Christmas Day when there's a lot more attendance. This is actually sort of a down week. And in fact, it's a down week overall compared to last year. But it's a down week because people are still shopping and they're not quite focused on movies for this particular week. But both can be expected to have strong legs. Audiences liked them that saw them. So we'll see. Number five around the world is New Year's Eve, the multi-star cast romantic comedy. It costs $16 million worldwide. It's at $52 million and counting. It's got about another week and a half before it's old news.
You know, I actually saw Gary Marshall at Cantor's Deli on Sunday, and I was so tempted to run up to him and just say two words, Arbor Day.
At number six is Arthur Christmas, another movie that will be old news at the end of the holiday, but is still very timely. It grossed $13 million worldwide. It's grossed $111 million worldwide to date on a $100 million budget, roughly. I saw it over the weekend. I thought it was absolutely delightful. I think it'll be on my list of the best films of the year. It's a very, very good film.
I told you, I've been telling everybody to go see this movie, and actually one of our listeners... unfortunately, I only know his Twitter name, so maybe I shouldn't use it. But one of our listeners actually said that he saw it on our recommendation and really enjoyed it. So
it's a terrific movie. It's not making a lot of money based on, you know, compared to the budget, but this is going to be a holiday perennial. It's a very good holiday movie. It's smart. Little kids, there's enough action going on that they can enjoy it, but it's a very smart, sophisticated film that older kids and adults will like a lot. It's a very solid, strong holiday film. Really, it's a very good movie in general. It's got a great voice cast. Bill Nighy, James McAvoy, Imelda Staunton, Jim Broadbent. Great cast. Terrific script. Very well done. You're going to be watching it for years to come. Trust me. At number seven around the world is Twilight Saga Breaking Dawn Part 1. Another $12 million worldwide. $658 million and counting. At number eight is Hugo, the Martin Scorsese film, which grossed $5.6 million worldwide. It's just opening a tad in France and a few other places. That's mostly still the U.S. It has grossed $41 million worldwide on a $150 million budget. So still far, far away from being a commercial success. However, he does hope to be getting some Oscar nominations soon. At number nine around the world is Intouchables, the French film that we lost track of last week. It grossed another $5.5 million. It's at $123 million worldwide and counting, including a little money from Belgium and Switzerland. It costs $13 million to make. And yes, I did finally see notice that the Weinsteins did, in fact, pick up the English language remake rights for this comedy about a quadriplegic like millionaire and his homeless ex-con caregiver, whatever the guy. You know, it's this ridiculous broad comedy. You'll be hearing about it down the road. And number 10 around the world is The Sitter, which goes $4.4 million worldwide. It's at $17.7 million and counting on a $25 million budget. And just below that, you have Young Adult, The Muppets, and The Descendants, all grossing around $3.5 million in the U.S. And The Muppets has also started to open up overseas. So that's the weekend at the box office. It was a little down from last year. This year is looking like it will probably be down from last year, which was, of course, the second biggest year of all time. Overseas, around the world, the rest of the world, we are already setting a record box office. So this will be the biggest year all time internationally. Whether it will be the biggest all-time worldwide gross, I'm not quite sure. We'll have to figure that out.
Right. Well, you know, as more and more multiplexes get built around the world, you know, for the most part, internationally, the world was underscreened. So like in a place like Brazil, where you have 300 million people living in Brazil, you have 2,000 screens. Well, to give you some perspective, in the U.S., we have between 300 and 400 million people, and you have, you know, 39,000 screens. So.
Right.
Yeah,
Brazil, China, India, there's a lot of room for growth there.
Right. So as more and more India, China, Brazil, as you mentioned, as
brick,
they get
brick,
more
brick,
yes.
The brick countries.
Brazil, Russia, India, China. As they get more screens put in, they will actually, the international grosses will go up. So it's just natural. So that you're going to see that international gross will account for about 2/3 of a film's gross.
It should be more than that. I mean, there's 300 million people here and 6 billion people in the rest of the world. It should be 80, 90%. Why not?
Well, I think it's a matter of culture and, you know, for us going to the movies.
The Mission Impossible speaks to the world.
Yes, but not, you know, Winter's Bone does not. So
But when you are promoting your films internationally, it helps to have some award status, like A Separation, the Iranian film, will probably get a good amount of attention and people will go to it because it's probably on the short list for the Oscar Best Foreign Film thing. We'll have to see how it does, whether it gets on that final list. But it's definitely on some year-end lists and getting all that attention.
So I'm surprised that Margin Call isn't on more people's lists. I know you have a little note here about Margin Call grossing another $110,000 on 120 screens and has made $5.1 million in theaters and another $4 million being released day and date via video on demand.
Yeah, this is really a really strong success story for video on demand. It's the ideal film for it. It has big names in it, relatively, you know, strong names, but it's a small film. It's never going to open on, you know, 2,000 screens. So rather than not making it available at all to people in a lot of the country, they make it available day and date video on demand. And so people go see it in the theater when they can. Other people don't even know that it's available on video on demand and they go to the theater. Other people in cities where it's not playing read the reviews, they hear the attention, they check and they go, oh, I can watch it at home. And they watch it for $6-7. And it's worked really well for this film. So, you know, we're going to be seeing more of this for independent and small films. We already have. The question is whether it will ever make sense for a big blockbuster Hollywood movie.
It doesn't seem like it would. And I, you know, I have to say, Margin Call, great movie, well worth seeing. And it's one of those topical movies where it pays to see it while it's in the public's mind because it's a part of the conversation. You're right, releasing it VOD and theatrically at the same time made it a national conversation rather than a conversation in certain cities that had the film and then later on video. I mean, you're absolutely right.
Yeah, it was perfect because it came out just as Occupy Wall Street was happening. So this film about the financial meltdown suddenly seemed timely rather than a depressing reminder of how we got in this mess we're in. I just got the DVD. I'm looking forward to watching it. I haven't seen it yet. It's definitely on my short list of things to watch before the end of the year.
But, you know, the Screen Actors Guild, Golden Globes, even critics' year-end lists, it didn't make the list at all. I'm really surprised. Nobody saw this film that needed to vote on it, or they forgot it by the time they needed to nominate some of these films.
Yeah, it's still not out of the run for Oscars because it does have a lot of Oscar people in it, but it's and there has been some, you know, nominations or attention in the margins on smaller awards. But it's definitely not in the mix for the big stuff. It hasn't been getting a ton of attention. But the SAG Awards and the Golden Globes did come out this week, their nominations. And I should have said last week when we covered the batch of year-end award winners, I said the next one that matters is the Golden Globes. Well, some of you probably yelled at your podcast, well, what about the SAG Awards? And, you know, you're right and I'm wrong. I mean, because actors make up the biggest voting block at the Oscars. So in many respects, the SAGs, which have only been around for 16 years, are more telling of what Oscar might do than the Golden Globes. And we really should pay most attention to not the critics in New York and L.A., not the Golden Globes, but to the SAG, the Directors Guild, the Producers Guild, the Cinematographer Guild. Those are the people who are actually going to be voting on the Oscars. So they're the ones that really matter most of all. And the SAG nominations came out, and the winners, the nominees for Best Ensemble are, you know, going to be very strong contenders for the Best Picture nomination. They are The Artist, the black and white film we love, Bridesmaids, which has been getting a lot of attention lately, The Descendants, the George Clooney film, The Help, and Midnight in Paris. Those are the five picks by SAG actors. Now, this group of people voting is much bigger than the pool of Oscar actors.
By a long shot. I mean, I think there's like 80,000 Screen Actors Guild members, and there's 6,000, 7,000 members of the Academy.
Exactly. So this is right. A much broader range. But, you know, there they are in the mix. They also voted on TV, some TV stuff for drama and comedy. And then the Golden Globe nominations came out. The Artist was a big winner. It got 6 nominations. The Descendants and The Help both got 5 nominations. George Clooney's Ides of March also got a boost. It had been sort of fading, and now it's back in the mix.
Well, it received relatively mixed reviews for the most part. When it screened in Toronto and Telluride and Venice, it was kind of people didn't really care for it.
Well, it got mixed reviews. It didn't do well at the box office. I imagine it will be completely forgotten by Oscar because it probably doesn't deserve to be. This is an example where the Golden Globe said, we'd love to have George Clooney at our show.
Yeah, that's the thing. You look at some of these nominations, and just like last year where they nominated The Tourist, why did they nominate The Tourist? Because they wanted Johnny Depp and Angelina Jolie to walk down the red carpet and sit in the Beverly Hilton for 3 hours during the telecast. And I think the same thing is true every year with the Golden Globes.
That's right. That's why we should pay less attention to it. But Arthur Christmas, which we mentioned, is in the mix for Best Animated Film. along with Rango, Tintin, Puss in Boots, and Cars 2. God knows why that got in.
I think it's just out of sheer, it's a Pixar film, okay, I'll vote for it. I think out of sheer inertia, people voted for it.
So, you know, SAG Awards are probably more telling, though, again, it's a much bigger body of people. You got a lot of TV people voting. But soon, when the Oscar nominations go out, we'll be able to focus on what really matters.
But you know what? One film, one animated film that you will not be able to vote for if you're an Academy member is The Smurfs, believe it or not. It was disqualified from the, I guess, apparently, and this is the thing, nobody knows why it was disqualified, but Alvin and the Chipmunks, Chipwrecked, was approved for consideration, whereas The Smurfs was disqualified. And, you know, there's people pointing to the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Science rules that say, quote unquote, a significant number of the major characters must be animated, and animation must figure in no less than 75% of the picture's running time. Well, the film is named The Smurfs, and The Smurfs are animated.
And they're in every frame of the movie, practically. I mean, there are scenes with humans in it with no Smurfs, but very few.
Yes, I mean, the whole thing is just totally Smurfed up.
Oh, God. you know, these are weird hybrids, let's be fair. They are live films with live actors in them interacting with animated characters. You've got the Smurfs running through Central Park. You've got Alvin and the Chipmunks on a desert island. It's not a pure animated film. It's not a pure live action film. It is hard, and you want to be fair and figure out where it belongs. It's not easy. You know, it's hard to come up with a hard and fast rule because the technology changes so much. And what is Avatar? I mean, to me, that's
an animated movie.
Yeah, you know, so it's very hard to say how you categorize these things. So let's not throw a stone.
Well, you know, the last Planet of the Apes movie could be considered partially animated. Andy Serkis playing the motion captured ape. Caesar.
Yes, though again, I would doubt that 75% of the film you had Caesar front and center. I don't think apes are even in 75% of the film.
Well, there you go. Then yeah, you're absolutely right about that. I would agree.
Because there's a lot of scenes with just humans and live animals and all that sort of stuff. So it's hard to say.
You know, the Screen Actors Guild did not overlook Carnage, which is the Roman Polanski film based on a Broadway play.
Everyone else will.
Everybody, yeah. Jodie Foster nominated for Carnage. They also didn't forget Moneyball, which I think is a great film. I really liked it. Brad Pitt was nominated for Best Actor in a Motion Picture.
Yeah, that seems to be the movie they're gravitating towards. He was in Moneyball and The Tree of Life, a far superior film. And this seems to be the one that they're, you know, giving their attention to for the end of the year awards. It's always tricky. Jessica Chastain is in 6 or 7 films. So, you know, you can really get lost in the mix. Somebody votes for you for The Help. Someone else votes for you for The Tree of Life. Suddenly, you don't get any nominations. That's why it's sometimes fairer in the critics group polls, because they say, we're going to nominate you for your body of work during this year. And so they can list all 6 movies. And you don't get lost in the shuffle.
Well, I mean, was there any big surprise where you just thought, what the heck? Why are they? I mean, I totally forgot about that film in either of these, the Screen Actors Guild or the Golden Globes. Any big surprises?
No, because I don't really take them seriously. Their TV is especially stupid.
Well, yeah. I mean, every year.
And it's Golden Globes that have this ridiculous mix in television where the supporting nods come from comedies, dramas, miniseries, TV movies, as far as I know, probably variety shows. I mean, it's just a ridiculous mix of people, you know.
Well, now, speaking of ridiculous mixes of people, we have this story about the Bourne Identity controversy, and I am completely confused by it. I know Matt Damon was talking to GQ magazine, and he said something negative about Tony Gilroy, the writer of the original film, and you know a lot more about this than I do, but it includes the producers and directors and the writers and the Universal Studios executives. What is going on here?
I think this is just interesting, and we've linked to the story in The Hollywood Reporter because it gives you a glimpse of how Hollywood really works, which we don't always get, and it lets you a sense of how things come up, how people have fights and vendettas, how they can still work with each other even if they don't like each other, and how projects come together and what studios do, how they deal with the actors who are big stars. I think it's very interesting. We've linked to it. You should really read the whole story. It's very good. But we all found out about this infighting from this GQ article, and everybody said, my God, Matt Damon, he's so nice. He never says a negative thing about anyone. What happened? Why did he do it? And The Hollywood Reporter did their work, did the story, interviewed everybody, got Matt Damon on board to talk about it so they could explain how it happened.
Well, now, we should say, what did he say that was so negative? He was talking
about... Well, he said screenwriter Tony Gilroy turned in the script, I think, for the third Bourne film that was unusable, unreadable, and I could end his career if I just released this draft. It was so ridiculous.
Right.
And, you know...
And he was kind of insinuating, if I'm not mistaken, that, you know, Tony Gilroy only was, liable for one draft. He was only hired for one draft, And that's all he was contracted to do. He handed it in, kind of tossed it off because he knew he wasn't going to be a part of it beyond that.
Well, I think it's almost the opposite of that, where he was annoyed that Tony Gilroy walked away from the project after doing just one draft. Not that Tony Gilroy didn't bother because he only had to do one draft, but he felt he shouldn't have done just one draft. He needed to do more. This was a big franchise for them, and why walk away from it? But now I'm looking into Matt Damon's mind, which is something I can't really do. But in any case, very unhappy with him. He didn't get along with Tony Gilroy. We found out Paul Greengrass, the director of the second and third films, you know, didn't like him at all. They clashed repeatedly. So what the heck's going on? Why did this become public and how did it happen? And Hollywood Reporter lays it all out. The first film, The Bourne Identity, was melting down. The director was Doug Liman, but the producer, Frank Marshall, and Tony Gilroy saved it. And so Matt Damon liked them. But on the second film, you know, Damon bonded with director Paul Greengrass, and he's like, the director is the man. He's in charge. It's his baby. He's the one. And so his whole loyalty and support was to Paul Greengrass. Unfortunately, Greengrass and Tony Gilroy hated each other. They clashed repeatedly. Tony Gilroy is the type of guy who wants the screenplay totally mapped out beforehand, a la Hitchcock, where you know every little, you know, angle and thing, what's going on. Greengrass likes to have a loosey-goosey set and keep things fast-free and, you know, be improvised.
If you've ever seen Tony Gilroy's work, and you most likely have. Michael Clayton is one of his movies. Duplicity is one of his movies. You know, he's very exact in terms of the script and what's said and when and why. He's kind of a perfectionist in that way.
Right. I mean, they've both made terrific films. Let's leave
yes.
it at that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So they were working together on the second film, but they didn't like each other. And Damon was siding with Greengrass. But on the third film, the studio was like, here's your deadline, Paul Greengrass. We need a script idea. We need a script for the next film. What are we going to do? And he could not come up with a story by the deadline. And there's a deadline because of the estate of Robert Ludlum, who wrote the books and the studio and all this sort of stuff. And of course, they want to keep the franchise going because it was very profitable.
So there's a ticking clock to this story, just
Absolutely.
Like in any good movie.
He couldn't do it up. You know, it wasn't possible. He couldn't come up with it. So they turned to Tony Gilroy, the studio did. And he wrote a first draft, and he made clear he was committed to Michael Clayton, which, of course, stars Matt Damon's buddy, George Clooney. He was committed to that film, and he couldn't do anything more than one draft. And everybody understood that, and he turned it in. The studio liked it enough to greenlight it. They made the film a go. But Matt Damon thought it was a piece of junk, and he should never have walked away, and was very angry about that, and felt like, you know, he wasn't doing right by the franchise.
Well, wait a second. Who's the Academy Award-winning screenwriter here? Matt Damon is. Tony Gilroy has been nominated, yes, but he's never won.
Matt, get to work, Matt.
Exactly. Pick up a gosh darn pen, for Pete's sake.
But they made that film. None of us knew they were unhappy with each other. And again, they wanted to make a fourth film, even though they said they would just make a trilogy. They were all ready to make a fourth film, but Greengrass, again, couldn't come up with a script idea. No, and even though the studio had backed his movie Green Zone, the $100 million political drama, co-starring Matt Damon. They backed this movie to make him happy. The movie was a big flop. So everybody wanted to work together on Bourne, but Greengrass could not come up with a script. So the studio went to Matt Damon. And then Ron Meyer, Adam Fogelson, Donna Langley, all the top Universal execs sat down with Matt Damon. They had dinner, and they said they wanted to hire another director. And Damon said, if you don't have Paul Greengrass, you don't have Matt Damon. So they went to Tony Gilroy, who came up with another script. and they, you know, they felt they tried their best. He could have pulled a Bond. They were thinking of doing that, pulling a Bond and saying, all right, we're going to recast Jason Bourne. But they didn't. Gilroy came up with an idea that involved another character that would leave the door open for Jason Bourne to return. So Matt Damon was sort of happy about that, as was Greengrass, as much as they could be with Gilroy. Came up with this new idea. And, you know, okay, they'd moved on, he moved on, left the door open for maybe something down the road, and, you know, whatever happened with this movie happened. But then Matt Damon is on his new film in Vancouver, a film called Elysium, from the director of District 9, and their offices are in Vancouver, and right across the street, or right next door, right in his sight line, every day when he goes to work, are the offices for The Bourne Legacy. So every day when he goes to work, he's sort of like, Tony Gilroy. You know, he didn't do his job on movie 3, and now not only is he writing movie 4, but he's directing it as well. He's taking over the franchise, taking it away from me, taking it away from my buddy Paul Greengrass, and it just needled him and bothered him and festered until finally when he did an interview with GQ, it all came pouring out.
Right. So that's the whole Bourne controversy, which will be the sixth film in the series.
I'm sorry. I just think them taking him out to dinner, how the offices happened to be next to each other in Vancouver, how, you know, they had all this infighting that we knew nothing about while they made these first three films. I found that all fascinating.
And you know what? In most cases, that's really what's going on these films. Maybe not to this extent, but there's all of this, you know, there's always a story behind the story.
That's true.
We should move on maybe to television news. And really, we don't have that much news about, say, television stars or television shows.
A lot of reruns this week, but I will tell people that there are some traditions that happen every year on the late night talk shows. My favorite is on David Letterman Friday night. Make sure you record Letterman and make sure you record a few minutes after the end of the show so you don't miss the finale, because it always gets cut off if you use your DVR.
To me about that. Between New Girl and Raising Hope, Fox just cannot go all the way to the end. I mean, it's ridiculous. None of these shows record to the end.
Well, that's why I always record a few minutes extra, or if I want to record two or three shows, I record one show for an hour and a half beyond what it should be. You know, that sort of thing. That's my trick. But Letterman, Friday night, Darlene Love, she does it every year. She comes in and sings Christmas Baby, Please Come Home. It's awesome. They always do a fun new production every year with a full orchestra and snow, and it's a blast. So check that out Friday night.
Wow, I will definitely do that. I did not know that. As long as I've been watching that show and having worked on it, I did not know that. That's interesting.
It's always the last show of the season before Christmas. That's not a rerun. And this year it happens to me Friday.
Ah, okay. Well, the news this week, besides David Letterman's Christmas finale, is not necessarily about television shows like The Letterman Show, but about television itself. And I know both Michael and I felt the same way when we saw this story. It's in the Wall Street Journal, and the headline is Apple Plots Its TV Assault. And I'm sure.
Finally. Oh, my God. Apple's coming to TV. Yes. What happened? What's the story? Well, what's the news, Sperling?
Well, I'm sorry. There is no news, actually. I'm sure if you have a pulse, you've probably heard that Apple, the company that makes our iPods and iPhones and iPads and computers, they are supposedly working on a television set, a next generation television set. However, details are vague. And the Wall Street Journal story says, oh, they've been meeting with media executives to go over, you know, everything, but they're not licensing any content for it. And even executives at Apple are wondering, you know, well, what's the deal with this whole TV thing? Well, what are we going to be doing with it? And Steve Jobs, while alive, kind of declined to work on it. In fact, he responded, and this is from the Wall Street Journal, that it would be a bad business to get into, noting that the margins on television are far lower than the margins Apple makes from its other devices, and that consumers don't buy new televisions very frequently, according to the person who was telling the Wall Street Journal. And that's very true. I mean, people buy televisions once every 10 years, and the margins are like, you know, maybe 5%, 12%, as opposed to 50% or 90%, which is what Apple's making on all of their other hardware.
Apple doesn't make a 90% profit margin on anything.
Oh, okay. Well, maybe software.
Well, I don't know about that, but yeah. But yeah, electronic devices, televisions are... you know, I've bought a TV 2 years ago. I'm not going to buy one for another 5 or 6, 7 years. I'm certainly not going to rush out and buy a 3D TV. But everybody wants Apple to solve the problem. Everybody's tackling this. Everybody wants to be your gateway to television. They want to create the set-top box. They want to create the portal that will let you access television and streaming content via the web and home stuff that you create all on your TV screen in a simple, easy way. Apple's been trying to crack this nut for many years, and they haven't, as far as we know, there's no news here. They haven't come any closer. They haven't developed a product. They haven't said, here's what we're going to do. You know, they've just said, oh, we'd sure like to.
I mean, the story doesn't quote a single source other than, you know, unnamed sources. And they're all saying the same things, which are, oh, it's going to use Apple's AirPlay technology so that you can move content from the television to an iPhone or an iPad and take it with you. And you'll be able to control it with your voice. So basically what you're saying is you've happened to have read Apple's product catalog, and you're taking all of the features from all of the other products and jamming them into a television set and then being quoted in the Wall Street Journal. Is that pretty much what the story is here? And the answer is, in my opinion, yes.
And they've been trying to do this for years with their little Apple TV box, right? I mean, they were trying to be the portal to stream stuff from your laptop or your computer to your TV already, and it never really took off.
Yeah, I think for them, and I think for Steve Jobs and his team there, I think that was just kind of a, let's see what we can do in this space and see, let's experiment. And that's what came out of it.
Yeah.
And, you know, meanwhile, you've got Congress trying to deregulate television. Representative Steve Scalise, who is a Republican from Louisiana, and Senator Jim DeMint, who is a Republican from South Carolina, they've submitted a cable and satellite friendly bill called the Next Generation Television Marketplace Act, which is, you can't like shorten that in any way, NGTMA, I suppose. Now, this would end. You know how we've talked about retransmission consent and retransmission rights in the past, Michael?
Uh-huh.
It would totally end that. So all those rules that require pay TV providers to negotiate a deal with a local broadcaster to then carry the programming, those would be done away with. It also would end restrictions that it would allow syndicators to sell shows exclusively into different markets and would throw away the rules that bar cable companies from importing network programming from out-of-market stations. So you'd be able to watch the LA station in New York and vice versa. So this is just a bill that I think is going absolutely nowhere because the National Association of Broadcasters, the lobbying group for broadcasters, will just come in and stomp all over this bill. I mean, how could you? Basically, it would deregulate broadcast television and cable television and just allow all of these networks to steal from each other. It's just a complete mess.
Is there anything driving the creation of this? I mean, why? What problem are they trying to solve with this legislation?
I think that these two particular representative and a senator, I think what they're trying to solve is they have campaign contribution issues. And somebody paid them to write up this bill and propose it, even though there is no way it will ever be passed.
And they have no constituents in their home territory. One guy's from Louisiana and the other guy's from South Carolina. Not exactly the television industry, you know, heartbeat center of the country, are they?
No, not at all.
They're not in New York. They're not in L.A. They're not in some Georgia where, you know, CNN is based or TBS. I mean, you know, what possible skin do they have in this game? Nothing.
Yeah, but
except, like you say, donations.
Right. I mean, and there isn't even a lot of controversy over this or a lot of talk about this and pushback because people just don't even think it's going to pass. Unlike, say, SOPA and PIPA. Now, SOPA is the Stop Online Piracy Act making its way through the House of Representatives in Congress.
But it just stalled this week, right? It stalled in committee.
Yes. And I mean, there's, if you watch this stuff, I mean, at one point, the chair of the committee in the House of Representatives was tweeting that the person speaking on SOPA was so boring that they decided to surf the internet. The person who was speaking found out about it, and I mean, it's a zoo. It's a complete zoo. Over in the Senate, you have the PIPA, which is the Protect IP Piracy Act, and you have all of these technology groups coming out against both of these bills, specifically SOPA, because I guess they feel that's the one that has the most chance of passing and is the most egregious in what it will be trying to do to stop piracy.
So it's a clash between the companies that build the devices and the companies that create the content. The studios and the record labels are all for it, right?
Oh, yes. They really
so
like
not
it.
Like, they're not alone. I mean, this isn't like this other legislation where nobody is supporting, you know, there's nobody pushing it particularly. This is a big titanic clash between content creators and people like computers and iPads and technology people.
That's right. And you have people who are, well, not necessarily the people who are making the hardware, but the people who like created SMTP, the people who created TCP/IP. So every time you log on to the internet, the protocols for how you log on, those people are saying, look, if you pass SOPA, you will break the internet. You will basically put something in the way between the website and the web browser. So when you go to Amazon and Amazon says, yes, I am Amazon, here's my certificate. You can verify that I'm Amazon and all of your credit card transactions will be okay. That will break. And so it would be like sending a piece of mail to you, Michael. And instead of me sending it directly to you, it would have to go through a third party before it got to you. And if that third party decided that you didn't really need to see that mail, it just wouldn't forward it to you.
But legislators are probably too stupid to realize how dangerous that is.
Yes, that's correct. And actually, finally, last week, in the SOPA debates, as they were kind of marking up the bill and making revisions, they said, you know what, before we do this, we have no idea what we're doing here, and we are going to break the internet, as many of these people have said. So let's get some real experts in, and we'll do that as soon as possible in the new year. And then, in the midst of all of this, we had this fair use battle, which kind of highlighted the problem with both of those bills.
And as our readers have pointed out, the problem when you do not have, judicial oversight or any sort of controlling body, not letting these people run rampant and just slap down and shut down any internet site they don't like.
Right. And you had the Department of Homeland Security close a website called DeJazz One, I think, DeJazz1.com. And they closed down 81 other websites as well. But they claimed that this website, DeJazz One, was posting illegal files, illegal music files, and sharing them on their hip-hop blog. Well, it was a hip-hop blog, and they had permission, that blog had permission from the record companies to do so. Except usually the marketing department doesn't know that the, or one department doesn't know the marketing department has given permission to a blog to post something. So ICE, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement group, came in and shut it down for an entire year. And they couldn't, this website hired attorneys who were working pro bono. They couldn't figure out why they were shut down, especially since they adhered to every takedown notice, which is a way of a content owner saying, hey, don't put that up there. That's mine, and you don't have the right to do that. And they adhered to all of them. So all of a sudden, and this was, I have to thank Jared Harris of Philadelphia who sent this story in. All of a sudden, you know, ICE just kind of, and the Department of Homeland Security released the domain and said, okay, you can have your domain back, without saying a single thing about why they confiscated it or seized it in the first place. Meanwhile, this website lost an entire year of its life and is completely dead at this point.
Number one, this should not be under the domain of the Department of Homeland Security. This is a commercial thing. It's nothing to do with Homeland Security. If somebody's stealing a song, that shouldn't fall under their purview. You know, if they're getting involved in this, you know, this is ridiculous.
I think the reason that is through a loophole. I'm not condoning it.
No, I understand. They it was their you know, Immigration and Customs Enforcement or ICE Director John Morton was involved. You know, Attorney General Eric Holder, at least, you know, he's got more skin in the game. But Homeland Security, you know, this is not a threat to our nation's security. This is just somebody robs a grocery store that you shouldn't have Homeland Security involved. That's a waste of their time and energy. Two, of course, with all the genuine pirate sites out there, to take down one that actually was not a pirate site is unbelievably pathetic and shows how little oversight there was and how there was, you know, they just randomly went after something not knowing what they were talking about. That's unbelievable.
Well, what's unbelievable is that in the midst of all of this going on in Congress, you had Universal Music Group taking down off of YouTube this mega upload video, which featured some of their artists singing original work about mega upload. Well, this whole thing blew up. When,
are they singing or are they talking? I thought they just said, I love Mega Upload.
No, they were kind of singing and they, you know, kind of joking around singing. It wasn't like a...
So Mega Upload is a website that a lot of people consider to be involved in helping people share pirate material, right?
Correct.
They're based in Australia.
Yes.
And they ran a commercial, which they spent $3 million on, which I'm like, why the hell did it cost you $3 million to make this? But anyway, they had a commercial featuring some big name celebrities saying, I love Mega Upload.
Right.
Mega Upload's awesome. You had people like, who was on this thing?
Will I Am, Jamie Foxx. I mean, you had a lot of people singing.
And they posted this online, and Universal said, oh, you're breaking our copyright. And they had it taken down. There's sort of an automated system in which major companies like Universal can go to YouTube and automatically block something, right?
Right. They basically, what Universal or other groups will do is give YouTube the content. YouTube servers then fingerprint it and say, okay, anything that matches this kind of audio wave and these audio fingerprints, just take them down because that's obviously the same content and Universal doesn't want that content up. Okay.
But they somehow gamed the system and had content taken down that they had nothing to do with whatsoever.
Right. Now, there's a podcast called Tech News Today. It's a podcast over at This Week in Tech's network, which I've actually been on the podcast Tech News Today.
Because you're a twit.
Thank you, I suppose. But they did a story, and I remember listening to this podcast, and they have a video podcast to go along with the audio podcast. And I remember listening to this episode and hearing them talk over this video as they were kind of explaining the story, much the way you and I were doing, except they were actually showing the video and, you know, the music was kind of faint underneath it.
Right. This was a news story about Universal's abuse of copyright laws to take down this mega upload video from YouTube. This was a news story reporting on what they'd done, just like we're doing now.
Right. And what happens? Their video posted to YouTube, Tech News Today's video posted to YouTube, gets pulled. Why? Because of the little snippet of video and audio shown and talked over this mega upload video. So that's
right. So Mega Upload created their own original commercial. Universal erroneously claimed that they had copyright on that.
Well, that remains to be seen, but that's, yeah, I mean, that's what the whole court
is. Universal's vague about why they believe they had the right to try and block Mega Upload, but they did. And then in a news story about this abuse of the system, they then claimed that Tech News Today was breaking their copyright, even though there's no question they were using fair use, even if it was copyrighted material, because they were using just a few seconds of music and they were talking over it. And the material came from Mega Upload, had nothing to do with Universal in the first place. And now on Friday, YouTube did clarify that Universal had abused the system, that they, you know, had a video taken down. They had no underlying rights to whatsoever. Universal still refusing to even come up with a possible reason why they can claim Mega Upload or Tech News Update abuse their copyright. Mega Upload is suing them in court. I hope they win a lot of money, because like we saw before with this, you know, this other website, they're out of business.
Yeah, they're,
you know,
right, yeah.
This is, they're very dangerous. And, you know, they need to take them to court and win a lot of money from them. You know, they have no reason why they could claim Mega Upload copyright infringed on them. Absolutely nothing. So, you know, this is just ridiculous.
And as far as TNT goes, this is precisely, I mean, here everybody's saying, oh, SOPA will be fine. Don't worry about it. Nothing's going to be censored. Everything will be fine. Yeah, it'll be going to a third party, and it kind of invites a man in the middle of attack and is completely insecure. But don't worry about it. We're not going to create the whole Chinese firewall thing. And meanwhile, at the very same week that they're saying that, this whole thing happens with TNT, proving that all of these bots and algorithms that take things down automatically because they think that a piece of content is not fair use and infringing don't work. In fact, Michael, you and I have suffered this with our videos from Can on YouTube.
Yes.
We were given video, you know, little snippets of video.
From
like
trailers, yeah.
Trailers to kind of promote the movie as we talked about it, and they get taken down, and then I have to go and file a please, you know, amend this, it's fair use. I don't know what the solution is. My gut would tell me have journalists and certain news organizations file for just some kind of identity with YouTube so that you can actually identify them and maybe keep them out of the algorithm. But it's just a nightmare.
It's a nightmare. And the funny thing is that Universal now claims to their lawyers that even if somehow Mega Upload thinks they have a case, it doesn't count as an official takedown under the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. And they can't be sued because, you know, they were just doing it through YouTube's private thing. It's got nothing to do with the law.
That's right. And that's actually very true. And so they said, look, it wasn't a DMCA takedown notice, which is a very official document and very official move. It was done through YouTube, which is a private, you know, privately done through YouTube. We have an agreement back and forth. So it wasn't a DMCA takedown notice, and we aren't abusing the DMCA, which is huge, like that could be a crime. So,
but they're claiming that they have no standing in court, which the Mega Uploads attorney said is preposterous.
Right.
You know, to claim that they didn't have any damage, it didn't abuse the system, it didn't, you know, break the law by claiming another company had broken their copyright when they'd done no such thing. You know, that's outrageous. So, you know, there you go.
Well, you know, there are some people who would say piracy is not an issue at all, that the people who are pirating music or movies or television shows are those that wouldn't have watched those shows or paid to see those movies.
They're wrong.
Okay, there are some who would argue that, and then
they're wrong. They're demonstrably wrong. That's ridiculous.
But at the same time, they're saying, "Well, where is the quantitative? Yes, quantitative analysis where you can say, okay, we lost exactly."
You don't need that. You don't need that. If you own something that if I build a desk and you steal it from my home and take it in your home, I don't have to prove what I might have sold it for or how much it's worth. I say, you got my desk. That's my desk. You don't have the right to it. If I write a book, I create a movie, I write a you know, record an album, and you have a copy of it without paying for it, and I didn't give it to you for free, you've stolen it from me. I don't have to prove how much money I lost. You stole it from me. You had no right to do it.
The courts actually, and the law actually does turn around and say, okay, well, you stole a car. That cost $30,000. That's grand larceny. So, you know, that punishment is more, you know, you could go to jail longer than if it was petty theft.
I didn't say that legally you ultimately wouldn't want to come up with some sort of metric for determining damages, but to say that you must prove exactly how much the music industry lost, the fact that we can say the music industry has collapsed in record sales and is, you know, a third of what it was 5 or 8 years ago, okay, but how can you prove how much sales there might have been? Well, it's impossible, and it doesn't matter. You still don't have the right to own every album by the Beatles if you never paid for it.
I'm not disagreeing with you at all. It was really just my way of moving us into a story about Louis C.K., who is a comedian who we reported actually on Showbiz Sandbox that he was going to do this live show at the Beacon Theater in New York, which Michael was going to be at.
No, I didn't go.
I know, I'm just throwing that in for good measure just to see if you were paying attention. Apparently you are. And he was going to record this show and then release it to his fans for $5 via the internet. He wasn't going to go through HBO or Showtime or
His own website.
Just his own website. And he spent.
And there'd be no digital right management on it. So you could just copy and do whatever you wanted with it.
Right. You could put it on your TV. You could put it on your iPad. You could put it on your Zoom. You do whatever you want with it. You paid for it. It's $5. Go away. You have my, I have your $5. You've got my video. And he is he's a very funny guy. He spent, $30,000 on the actual website itself, developing the website. He spent, another $150,000, $200,000 producing the show. But then, Michael, what happened?
Well, he's had success. He's sold 110,000 copies so far online, grossing $550,000, and by his estimates, netting about $200,000 after expenses. And he says, look, that's less than I would have been paid by a large company to just perform and let them sell it to you. But they would have charged you about $20 for the video. They would have given you an encrypted video of limited value. They would have owned your private information for their own use. They would have held international availability indefinitely. This way, you only paid $5. You can use the video any way you want, and you can watch it in Dublin or whatever cities in Belgium or Dubai. I got paid nice, and I still own the video, as do you, and everybody's happy.
Yeah, I mean, he actually said, yeah, I know it's on all the BitTorrent sites and is being pirated, and there's probably more people who have seen it because it was pirated. So 300,000 people probably saw it, even though I sold 110,000 copies. But because I'm being nice, people are actually coming to me, paying the $5 and not downloading it.
He did the right thing, which is to personalize it, make it realize that you're not just ripping off some multinational. You're taking money from this particular guy whose work you like. And he said, hey, he posted a note on his site or posted it around on other sites for people to see who might be ripping it for BitTorrent and said, hey, look, I'm just a guy. I paid for this, make it my own. I want to post it so people can get it this way. I want to do this in the future. So if you keep ripping it off, I won't be able to. I can't stop you from torrenting. All I do is ask you to pay your $5 and enjoy it.
Right. I mean, it was a huge story this past week because people were saying, look, you can go direct to fans. Now, mind you, you can do that if you're Louis C.K. You've had two television shows on FX. You've been doing this for how long now? I mean, I've saw him, 5, 6, 7 years ago play the improv. I mean, this guy is really well known. So,
well, yeah, and this is the story. People go on a major label, they build up a name, and then they go solo. He's been on television, he's been on cable, but ultimately Comedy Central and HBO didn't make sense for him for this project. And then once he's built up his brand via the big companies, so they are important, he can have the visibility to go solo and make money.
That's right, and that's exactly, and he leapt into his solo career.
It's a big deal.
Yes, I would say you're absolutely right about that. I think it was a big deal last week. It was the big deal news story. And, since you mention those two words so close together, big and deal, I think it might be time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our segment where we discuss the top entertainment news stories of the week and decide whether they are a big deal or whether anybody should care about them at all. Our first story, Howard Stern joins America's Got Talent. Howard Stern has replaced Piers Morgan on NBC's talent show America's Got Talent. Stern announced it on his Sirius XM satellite radio show, then he tweeted about it, and presumably at some point, someone sent out an email press release, although I didn't see one. I just saw all of the stories about his tweets and radio show. The show is moving to New York City to accommodate Stern. Last summer.
Now that's power.
That is power. I mean, look, the guy makes $500 million. What do you want? Last summer was AGT's highest rated season yet. Stern is controversial. Controversial? Controversial. He's been campaigning for a judging slot on Idol or AGT for years, and as soon as Morgan left, the Parents Television Council denounced the idea of Stern on the show since his radio work is so adult and raunchy. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a pretty big deal. I mean, he's been trying to get a judging job for years. It's not a big show. It's, highest ratings yet, but it's a summer show. It's not exactly a big player. But it'll be fun. I'm going to tune in to see what he's like. He knows what to do. When he's on Letterman and other shows, when he's in context on The View or something else, he knows how to play. In fact, I find him more interesting when he is on something like The View or Letterman than I do on his radio show.
Because he's kind of tamed. He's kind of being, held back, and
he has to be smarter and clever. He can't just say lesbian and curse.
Right.
So, those restrictions force him. And he's in somebody else's venue. So he's playing a game, and he's playing a role, and he's doing his job very well. And I think he's going to do a job very well on America's Got Talent. It'll make the show, I'm certainly going to tune in.
Amazon listed all the best-selling books on its site this year and broke it down by format, like hardcover and ebook. The results are fascinating since 40% of the best-selling ebooks did not appear on their list of best-selling print books. 4 of the top 10 best-selling print books weren't available as ebooks. The top 2 best-selling ebooks weren't available in print. 5 of the best-selling ebooks were singles, the category for expanded articles, short stories, and the like. Now, if you can actually repeat that back to me. In other words, people with e-reader devices are reading very different titles from people who read only print. Big deal or big what, Michael?
It's a very big deal because how it shows, like the two best-selling people with ebooks this year aren't in print. And, you know, all these things are becoming available from the New York Times saying, let's take our election coverage and package it together. Or I've done all this work for this article. And it's a really long story, but I actually have 100 pages of material. Let's release it as a single. You know, all these things are happening. New types of, you know, in-between formats are available. Authors are, again, taking back control and releasing ebooks on their own, not needing even to put out a print edition. And once you get into that ebook world, you're discovering and finding new titles and hearing about new titles that have nothing to do with what's all the big buzz books in the print world. And we assume they'll come together a little bit more down the road. But clearly, ebooks are expanding the possibilities for self-published authors, expanding the possibilities of what people are reading, novellas, short stories, expanded articles from newspapers and magazines they like the Atlantic Monthly or whatever. It's a very exciting how this is changing the game of what's getting published and what people read.
Do you hate those blaring TV commercials that seem to be 10 times as loud as the TV show you were just watching? So does the FCC. They've ruled that by the end of 2012, all ads must be no louder than the average volume of the TV show they are appearing on. That means no jumping for the remote when a show goes to commercial so your eardrums don't get blasted, kind of like they just did when I screamed into the microphone. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Oh, it's a big deal if anybody, I don't know. It's a big whoop for me because I don't ever listen to commercials. I literally do not. They're never there or I am DVRing and jumping past them. But it's a big deal for people who still listen to TV. And that was very funny.
Remember that item we had recently about the Van Halen tour that was going to be announced on the Grammy nominations TV show? Well, that wasn't the only act that might have made a splash. The Beach Boys were also going to be touted until bickering kept them from making an official announcement. Now that's all settled, and all the surviving original members of the band have come together for the 50th anniversary of when their surf pop first conquered the world. Brian Wilson, Mike Love, and Al Jardine are the core from the first group. Two of the others are no longer with us. And they'll be releasing a new album of original material, emptying the vaults with tons of reissues and box sets, and then, of course, spreading good vibrations with a massive tour. The vocals are shaky, but the hits are still solid. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big whoop, I guess, in general, but it's very fun. Endless Summer was on repeat when I was a kid growing up in the car with my sister, Libet. So I know their music back and forth. And Pet Sounds is one of the greatest albums of all time. I just saw a recent list where it is the number one album of all time based on a meta-analysis of all the postings of, you know, best albums of all time lists that have been around all over the world. They're a great band. They're well past their date of creativity and viability, but they're still a huge draw commercially in concert. It's fun to see Brian Wilson back with them. That's nice that they can put all their bad blood behind them. And they're recording new music, so who knows? Maybe they'll come up with something good.
Book sales are up for stores as the holiday approaches. Sales of books, you know, honest-to-goodness books, not those digital files or ebooks. They're up this holiday season, at least at all those stores that have survived. The New York Times says that stores around the country report good news for sales as shoppers pick up holiday gifts between Thanksgiving and Christmas. Especially noteworthy, coffee table books like a $75 ode to the Harry Potter films and another dedicated to showing every painting in the Louvre, alongside more traditional bestsellers like the Steve Jobs biography. So with same store year-over-year sales on the rise, big deal or big whoop, Michael? Can we just move on to the next one?
It's actually a big whoop because, as they point out, these are same store increases. With the number two bookstore chain in the country closing down, that's Borders, that means the remaining stores get a little bit extra bump in business. It's not nearly as much as the total business that was lost. But yeah, if you're in a small town and your Borders shut down, your business better see a 10 or 15% increase in sales or you're doing
really
something drastically wrong.
Yeah, I agree.
And I say, you know, coffee table books are the future, books that look beautiful. Since my sister doesn't listen to this podcast, I can tell all of you, don't tell her, but I bought Trisha Savage Beauty by Alexander McQueen, a lovely, gorgeous coffee table book that celebrates his show at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. She saw it and loved the show, and I got that for her for Christmas because I know she can't get it on her Kindle or her iPad, and she's going to really like it. And if she ever paid attention to what I did, she'd know that in advance.
Oh, first off, a couple things. She's got both a Kindle and an iPad.
Sure. I don't think she looks at the Kindle anymore, though.
Oh, okay. And secondly, why is she not listening to the show?
Oh, you know, she's never read a thing I wrote either, so don't take it personally.
Okay, well, Dios mío, manzana in Latin America. Apple is rolling out iTunes to a huge new chunk of the world. Apple is bringing the online music and video store to 16 Latin American countries, including Brazil, with an emphasis, of course, on Latin music and a 1,000-film library for rental or purchase. Back in the States, Apple is always looking to bring special editions to iTunes and is making a big splash with a new version of course, Avatar. That includes the ability to zoom in on scenes and see how they looked before special effects were added, a feature called green screen X-ray. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal. I think it's fascinating that it's taking them so long to get to Latin America, but I guess it's a lot of rights issues.
That's right, and a market that really just wasn't ready for it, frankly.
Well, I think they're more ready for it. I think Africa and Brazil and other countries, if you think they don't have a good store infrastructure, then they're even more ready for, you know, like you say, Brazil was underutilized with screens, so they'd be even more desperate to be able to download and stream movies to their, you know, to their product. But you know, 1,000-film library indicates how hard it is to get rights to do this, because 1,000 films is nothing.
That's right. Well, no, by not ready for it, I meant on a technological sense. I think, you know, like in Mexico, where I've done some work, the bandwidth was not there necessarily.
Oh,
so
well,
that might have been part of the issue.
Huh, interesting.
The NFL will be staying on network TV. Last week, the NFL came to an agreement with CBS, Fox, NBC, well, just those three, really, to continue the games they have on network TV through 2022. Did it cost big bucks? Yes, it did. All three networks are paying about $1 billion a year for their games. ESPN is shelling out $1.9 billion a year for its Monday Night Football franchise. NBC is getting 19 games, including a Thanksgiving Day game. CBS has games that line up perfectly with its wholly owned local TV stations. All of their deals include TV Anywhere clauses, so they can provide live streaming via tablets and laptops, though Verizon still has the exclusive on mobile phones. That comes up to about $5.1 billion a year for the NFL, and that's just for TV rights. Then they get to sell tickets, merchandise, jerseys, equipment, video games, and on and on and on and on. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
I mean, $5 billion a year. I mean, why exactly are my tickets $200 to go to see the game? I mean, the people in the stands are literally dressing, and they should be rewarding fans. Instead of seeing them as just another way to squeeze out a few more dollars, they should really be supporting their season ticket fans. This isn't maybe as big an issue in football, but I mean, I've had my Yankee tickets go up 75% in the last 2 years. A ticket that just 3 years ago cost $800 for a full season of 80 games, a great bargain, now costs $1,600. Right, that was they've doubled it in 3 years, 75% in the last 2 years during the worst recession. And you know what? They don't need the money.
Yeah, that's true.
We are window dressing. If they want people to show up, they say, oh, well, you're selling your tickets online, you know, on StubHub. It's like, well, yeah, because you keep raising the prices. So to be able to afford to go to 40 games a year, which is a massive commitment of time and money, I have to sell some off. And the more you raise prices, the more I have to sell off. And then you say, well, I'm going to raise prices more because you're selling them online. It's, you know, and people who go to one game a year are willing to pay top dollar, whereas if you're going to 40, suddenly that's, you know, that $20 a ticket is a lot of money.
It's a vicious cycle,
but I really think they need to rethink their approach to the fans in the stands and start to see them as a valuable property. If committed, excited, enthused fans are really important, and they need to start seeing them as more part of the whole game, rather, you know, something that helps get them a good product on television, because that's what matters and that's where they make the money.
You rhymed. Fans and stands. Yeah. The Weinstein brothers have a gift for turning movies into events. Their silent movie, Ode to Hollywood, called The Artist. Maybe you've heard us talk about it before? Well, it's a frontrunner for lots of Oscar nominations. But they know, to get the first foreign film in history to win Best Picture, they can't assume momentum will stay in their favor. So they had the brilliant idea of taking this silent film and playing it in major cities with a full orchestra performing the score by composer Ludovic Borse. An Oscar hopeful himself, by the way. New York, L.A., London, Paris, Brussels, Geneva, and even Australia are all possibilities. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a big stroke of marketing genius. I really do. It's just a way to keep the movie in people's front of people's attention. It's fun. It's appropriate for this movie because you often see silent films played with full orchestras. Some, you know, in special events around the country. I've seen it a number of times. I just went to see silent film at the Film Forum with piano accompaniment. It's always fun, and it creates the aura of this movie being a classic, you know, as opposed to like being a new movie. It's like, it's not just a new movie, it's a classic, and being treated just like those silent films from the past era. And it's just a fun event, and it's just a great way to keep attention focused on your movie and give something fresh for people to talk about.
Yeah, I mean, if they did this, I would probably take my kids to see it.
I mean, they will do it.
FX and Sons of Anarchy creator Kurt Sutter have won in court against an ex-Hell's Angel who had pitched his idea for a biker drama to FX via ICM, the talent agency, but he was turned down by FX. The judge ruled that Sutter had shown a clear development process, pitched the show to HBO and others before landing at FX via a bidding war, and that the show had its own creative life. As Sutter put it, having an idea is not the same as creating a show, buddy. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. I don't know the particulars of this guy's case, but yeah, you know, I had a biker drama that I pitched to every idea has been pitched a million times. I literally was working on a screenplay with a friend when that very idea was greenlit, starring Jon Favreau. I mean, it's just, you know, these things. And what's his name? His buddy, the tall guy.
Vince Vaughn.
Thank you.
Oh, Made? So, was it Made?
It was not Made, and okay. I should go back to our script again. But yeah, you know, you feel bad for the guy, but yeah, come on, you know.
No, wait a second. I was talking about the movie Made, which starred Vince Vaughn and Jon Favreau.
Oh, I thought you were asking whether the film project that they greenlit got made, and it didn't get made, actually. Okay. It was announced and was going to happen, but it fell apart. So my script is still good.
I say you shouldn't even be talking to me anymore. You should pen to paper. Yep. You can show Matt Damon how to do it. Apparently, he forgot. Madonna is set to dominate the world again. Madonna is not one for soft launches at all, as we know. She is following up the biggest solo tour of all time by performing at the Super Bowl, launching her first single, releasing her 12th studio album, and debuting her new film, We, all within a few weeks of each other in early 2012. The single, Gimme All Your Lovin', comes out at the end of January. The movie, February 3rd. The Super Bowl is February 5th. And the album in late March? You know, I don't think you're going to be able to schedule lunch with her that week, frankly. Big deal or big whoop? Now, did she have the biggest solo tour? Oh, solo tour. Okay.
Yep.
Okay.
She's number four of all time.
Okay.
It's a big deal because she's still a big superstar. As you say, people have lulls. I took issue with the headline in Deadline.com. They talked about it as a comeback and how she worked with her manager to develop a comeback. I'm like, comeback from what? You know, she's not coming back from anything. She's barely taking a lunch break. You know, she is the, you know, best female selling artist of all time, 300 million copies. Her Sticky and Sweet tour in 2008, 2009 grossed $408 million, the fourth highest grossing tour of all time behind U2, AC/DC, and the Rolling Stones. She played to 3.5 million fans, which made it the highest attended tour of the year. So it wasn't just high ticket sales that got her there. You know, her last album came out 4 years ago, not 5 years ago, in 2008. And since she released that album, she toured the world for 2 years, directed a film, and recorded a new album. You know, this is not a woman who needs to make a comeback. She's had lulls between her massive blockbuster albums like, you know, Like a Virgin and Music and Ray of Light. Yes. And those lulls include albums that sell 4 million copies, 10 million copies around the world. So, yes, you know, Hard Candy and American Life weren't huge. Confessions on a Dance Floor told 10 million copies. That would be a great career for most other people. For her, it's a lull.
Right. Yeah. Well, you know, I actually saw some of that tour, the last tour that she did, Sticky and Sweet. I was shocked at how in shape she is and how she still brings it. She's still got it.
She's a very good entertainer. She's always put on a good tour. Though if you look at her live albums,
they're horrible.
The live, not the concert DVDs, but the live albums, they've sold like barely 100,000 copies.
Yeah, well.
You want to see her for the spectacle. You're not there for the singing. Though she has worked, to be fair, on her voice over the years, and it's much stronger than it was at the beginning.
The story here really was that she signed a $40 million deal with Interscope Records, you know, three record deal.
Well, it's interesting that Live Nation thought she needed to do that. That's what it interested me here, because, you know, the whole point was Live Nation was going to handle everything.
I know. I didn't understand that. That was that's what made this a big deal to me, that it was a 360 deal. They were handling touring, albums, merchandise, and management. And in the end, they turned to a record company, which they were supposed to be replacing, to release the album.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's a smart thing to do. You know, it's a whole business in itself. So,
yeah, I think that's really what they learned is, you know what? Actually, we don't have a record distribution capability. So maybe we should just go to a record company for that.
Though they're probably, 40 million. I'm not sure who paid the 40 million.
That's Interscope. Yeah. Well, it's rumored to, it could amount to $40 million. You know, all those contracts, they don't pay $40 million. It's like, you know, if certain things happen, then you get a certain amount, which could lead up to $40 million.
This might be a case of them using them as a distributor, just like sometimes a filmmaker will make a movie and then a studio will distribute it for a fee or a flat fee or something like that with some back end. If it becomes a big success, you know, it looks like it might be something akin to that. They're saying, hey, you've got the structure in place. We're going to make use of you.
Yeah, it's a service deal. That's how George Lucas released the first three, you know, Star Wars films, the prequels, through 20th Century Fox. Fox got 15% or maybe even 10%. And
boy, I can't wait to see the Star Wars Episode One: Phantom Menace in 3D, a bad film in 3D. Wow, what an opportunity that will be.
Well, that'll be a true test to see whether 3D actually does make a film better.
I don't think it's a test. I mean, it's one of the best-selling films of all time, so there's certainly an audience for it. It's Star Wars. You know, people are going to show up.
Yeah, well, how many is the question.
Yeah.
Well, who knows? I mean, you know, this is all very kind of insidery, the whole service deals and whatnot. So, you know, maybe since we're doing that, we should move on to Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you.
However, you're going to have to do it solo because it's time. I got to go pick up my mom at the bus station at a Port Authority bus terminal. So you're going to have to fly solo on this. And happy holidays to everyone.
Well, Michael, thank you very much. Have a happy holiday, and I'll speak to you in the new year.
Bye-bye.
Well, it's a shame that Michael won't be able to join us for Inside Baseball this week because for Inside Baseball this week, we have Joe Fleischer, the chief marketing officer of Big Champagne. Now, you might recall we've spoken with Joe before when we talked about the Ultimate Chart, which, if you haven't been to it, it's one of my favorite internet sites. It is by far one of the best music sites out there to find out what's really happening in the music world. Joe, thank you for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me. Good to be back on.
Now, one of the reasons, well, really the main reasons we wanted to talk to you this week was because there I am, I think it was on Wednesday night, monitoring Twitter sort of out of the corner of my eye, and I see Jason Hirschhorn, who was the former head of MySpace and a number of other digital entities, and he's congratulating Big Champagne. And I thought, hey, wait a second. Why is Jason Hirschhorn congratulating Big Champagne? And so I went to Big Champagne's Twitter page, and there's all of these congratulatory tweets, and the Big Champagne person is thanking everyone. And I'm thinking, what am I missing? And it turns out I was missing quite a lot. Live Nation, who we talked about last week when we talked to Josh Barron and Dean Budnick, the authors of Ticketmasters, they of course, are a huge concert promoter, and now, of course, they've combined with Ticketmaster. They purchased you guys.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. We've known the Live Nation folks for you know, a little bit of time now, and it was such an obvious fit when we met earlier this year and started talking about, you know, what's exciting for them and what challenges lay ahead in terms of working with the, you know, the live fan and what we could bring to it. And really what we were looking for Big Champagne in terms of a platform to really go to that next level. So we're thrilled.
Well, maybe we should just back up just a bit and for our listeners, tell them exactly what Big Champagne is. I always call it a media tracking and statistics tool, but how would you describe Big Champagne?
I think that's pretty close. I mean, Big Champagne is a media measurement company, and we really began back in the very dawn of digital music when there really was only infringing content. So we were tracking the original Napster and Scour and Kazaa and guys like this, you know, the names that became synonymous with digital piracy. But even then, when we were watching these audiences grow and watching the amazing consumption, we knew we were monitoring the largest audience ever measured. And we knew that legitimate sources are coming and the value will be in these data in understanding music consumers and media consumers, you know, across really every type of media going forward. So Big Champagne invested very heavily our own money, since, you know, we've always just been a privately held bootstrap that never took any investment. We took it on ourselves to build a back-end sort of Babelfish-like engine to cross-match all these data sources that were coming on board and create a product that enabled people, actually a series of products now, enabled people to really understand album, artist, title, and really entities in the music business that governed the economy.
Well, and so I know after you were on last the last time, we got a lot of emails asking, well, wait a second, how is Big Champagne monitoring what I'm downloading? Not that I'm downloading anything illegally, but if I were, how would they be monitoring it? And I always wanted to just respond by saying, oh, because you're on Facebook. Of course.
Yeah. I mean, I think after F8, a lot of those questions are probably moot, right? I mean, I think the issue of, hey, am I sharing data publicly now in a lot of venues is answered affirmatively, right? That's certainly a big part of it. But we of course work directly with our data partners as well, with specific, you know, distinct proprietary feeds of data. And so the sources are very many for us. It's across physical and digital retail and all the streaming types, you know, broadcast, on demand, you know, subscription, and of course social and broadcast airplay with our partner media base. So it's really any touch point on the consumer.
And so, and really just to kind of translate that into semi-English, really, you're dealing with Napster, and you're dealing with, well, at the time, Kazaa, and you're saying, hey, look, let us know all of the titles that are being downloaded, because then we don't care who's downloading it. We just want to know how many times it's being downloaded, how often, and, oh, by the way, radio stations, tell us who you're playing, because we're going to add that to the mix. And, oh, by the way, record stores, tell us who you're selling, because we're going to add that to the mix, and somehow we're going to figure out who's really popular here. And ultimately, of course, it all goes into the Ultimate Chart, which is at ultimatechart.com.
By the way, that's exactly it. I think it was 2002, I went to Clear Channel with some early examples of what something might look like if we paired the basic marketing sequence of impression to reaction and presented it on a level where the stations could look at their DMAs and understand what they're playing and what they should play more, what they should play less, what fits their stationality. All of those things that were really critical to radio, which you have to keep in mind, even as recently as a few years ago, has been relying on things like call-out data and survey-based stuff where, you know, you're essentially calling a household at dinner time and hoping that somebody doesn't mind answering a, you know, the blocked caller ID, you know, call and being played a portion of a song that may or may not be the hook, and they may have a they may be a listener, they may not be, you know, they really didn't have a very good data source. So we presented this, you know, kind of crazy idea in 2002, and Clear Channel jumped immediately and said, we're in, here's a direct feed of all of our airplay data, you know, in a continuous feed. And we were off to the races. And exactly as you said, as new data sources came on, we started to round a view of the music business into shape that felt like, you know, I think maybe charts are kind of passe in the way they're being done. And rather than look at things in this kind of isolation around airplane sales, maybe we really should be looking holistically at the value and the weight and the depth and the, you know, the frequency, the penetration of artists and songs. And that was the Ultimate Chart. And of course, when we launched it, and you'll probably remember this, is, you know, I said, hey, it's the Ultimate Chart because we have these fantastic data sources. But I'm going to caveat that by saying we don't have live.
That's true.
And so it's really not that ultimate, right? And so immediately, you know, after the release of that, we began, you know, thinking about what we should do to really account for that. And of course, this relationship makes that writ large.
Well, it does. It's a relationship that's very interesting, because certainly when I heard Live Nation is purchasing Big Champagne, I mean, first off, my immediate sense was, well, shouldn't it be the other way around? Isn't it like AOL buys Warner Brothers? You know, shouldn't it be Big Champagne? But you know, all joking aside, I thought, well, wait a second. Live Nation, they sell tickets through Ticketmaster, and they're a concert promoter, and they own venues. They own, you know, certain amphitheaters and the like.
Sure.
What are they doing caring about data? And then it dawned on me, well, maybe that's exactly what they should be worried about. So what was it? Where were the synergies there?
Well, I think you sort of hit it on the head. I think that Michael Rapino and Nathan Hubbard have been consistently ahead of everyone in the music space in understanding the importance of getting to know your customer and really trying to super serve them and respond immediately and in a really agile way to bringing them the things they want. You know, based on things like, you know, proximity, affinity, immediacy, all the things that really are the touchstones of good data analysis and a good application of data. And so in speaking to them, it was clear they already knew that this was where they were headed and that Live Nation was really becoming a technology company and that we happen to have a set of skills and talent and products and competencies that were exactly the right fit and could be put to use across all areas of the company right away. So I would say that Eric and I were really bowled over by the two of them and their vision of it. So it was something I have not ever seen in the traditional media space.
Well, Michael Rapino is the CEO of Live Nation.
Yeah, he's a gifted guy, and so is Nathan Hubbard, and so it really didn't take long to round into shape what this was and what we were going to do together because we were all exactly on the same page.
Well, now I don't know if you've read the book by Josh and Dean, the Ticketmasters that I referenced earlier, but really, a technology company. It all started with technology. It all started with somebody saying, "How can I sell tickets through a computer?" And so now it's kind of come full circle.
Yeah, sure. It definitely has. And it's come full circle in the acknowledgement that you know, there's content that is valuable to the ticket buying music fan that maybe they're not really being served in the right context. And I think we're going to be able to do some good things around that.
Well, that is the one thing everybody wants to know. And everybody that, you know, if you kind of follow the Twitter stream, if you will, and what people were saying on Google Plus and all the social networks, really, people are saying, okay, so Live Nation buys Big Champagne. What are they going to do with that data? What are some of the advantages they will get from knowing that data? And what do you see them as?
So there are two immediate benefits in sort of separate silos about this specific relationship. Obviously, the rich trove of incredibly robust data that Live Nation and Ticketmaster have to put into our systems and serve our clients, our B2B clients, and our data partners better intelligence is an immediate win, and will have immediate effect that it's almost you just can't overstate it, because it really does really give us that view, that 360 view of everything that's going on with the artists and the albums and the songs, and in a way that just nobody else has, and so I think we really do have that one ultimate chart where you can kind of forsake everybody else now. Right, because the coverage is just so incredibly deep and broad. And then the second piece, and I can't go too far into, you know, teasing product stories and things like that about what we're developing, but keep in mind we have really great exogenous data that's historical and matched and beautiful and clean that we can really incorporate now across every touch point of this organization, of the Live Nation organization, in combination with existing data to understand the fan base and really just be incredibly quick and responsive to their needs.
So you're saying go backwards in time with the data that you have and the data that Live Nation has historically, combining them and saying, well, gee, did you notice that, and this is a hypothetical, but did you notice that when Airplane went up for insert name of artist here, their ticket sales went up as well?
Yeah, that's what we've been doing for years, right? And now we're just doing that with this great robust set of data that really nobody's ever worked with before. So needless to say, our devs couldn't be more excited. It's very hard to get anyone, you know, convinced that they should have any vacation days because everybody just wants to work around the clock. We're just it's the great geek moment at Big Champagne.
It's kind of a big win, and so you want to stick around the ballpark for a while.
Yeah, we've all been thinking about these data for so many years, and now that it's here, it's a Christmas morning for everybody, and it's hard to put the pens down.
Well, now you mentioned that, you know, you'll be able to service your clients better. Who are some of your clients? And I don't mean necessarily the names of them, but I mean, are they radio stations? Are they?
Yeah, sure. I mean, it's exactly that. It's anybody who really touches content and needs to understand the vector and the direction of it. And so, of course, you're right. You know, the broadcasters have been with us for many years. Content owning companies, the group that is probably the most adoptive of our products and services in the last couple of years have been agencies and brands, and specifically those brands that have really deep music initiatives, and that's really where so much of the music economy is moving. You know, as that economy trickles a bit from the center of the traditional content owners and out to the folks that are really brand marketing music. I think that's where you're going to find a lot of that good thought work being done.
Well, I mean, there are music supervisors who work for, and the only reason I bring this up is because you mentioned brands, but some of these music supervisors who work for brands, they have to go through all of this music to get one song that they're going to play 30 seconds of in a commercial, or they'll need, you know, a 2-minute clip for, you know, Bones or some television show. Are music supervisors kind of looking at, gee, who's hot, or are they always looking for who's going to be hot next?
It's both, you know, and the music supervisor's job, you know, as you've talked about it here, is also the component is, you know, are we really choosing the right artist and song that resonates with this specific demo that we're targeting, irrespective of age, or is the song hot now? Was the song hot at some point? The most important thing is it relevant? Are we really attacking that relevancy the best we can? And so I think that's where this is all heading. Thinking less about chart products as lists and more about chart as utility. How do we release this data that's underneath, you know, the ultimate chart into ways that really instruct and improve decision making?
Well, I know, lastly, when the last time you were here, we talked a lot about how Big Champagne monitors and tracks music, but there was some talk about maybe going into television and film. Have you expanded on that? And does the Live Nation acquisition preclude that?
Well, we've been working for television and film companies for many years, right? That there are just like there were in music initially, there were those companies that really invested in data and technology early, and those that have sort of lagged the curve, and so some of those sharper companies, or those more technology focused TV and film companies, of course, we continue to work for, and I don't believe that the relationship would preclude that. Anywhere that media is entering, you know, the ecosystem that the consumer touches and lives in, is something that we're going to be interested in.
Well, certainly, congratulations on the acquisition, and I look forward to seeing how the relationship evolves, and thank you very much for taking the time to join us and tell us all about it.
Yeah, sure, of course. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Have a good holiday.
All right, you too.
That was very nice of Joe Fleischer to join us, the Chief Marketing Officer for Big Champagne, which is a media tracking and technology company that was acquired by Live Nation last week. You can check out the Ultimate Chart online. It's ultimatechart.com. In fact, you can check out our website online. We're at showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find links to all of the stories we discussed in today's show. That's where you'll find ways to contact us. You can email us. The email address is dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can call us. The phone number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. That's also where you'll find ways to subscribe to the podcast. You can subscribe to us on iTunes, the Zune Marketplace, on Stitcher, through an RSS reader. Please feel free to subscribe and rate and review us on any one of those services. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Gilt, who had to leave us a little early, he can be found on his website, michaelgiltz.com. That's where you'll find links to all of his work. Some of my writing can be found on Celluloid Junkie or in Box Office Magazine. Again, please note, there will be no show December 26th or January 2nd, and we will be back January 9th. So until next year, play nice.